What I want to panic buy, to tell you the truth, is a chainsaw. Because I was thinking, looking out at my garden yesterday, and wondering what would happen were I to be trapped in the house for 14 days, I would want to lop a few branches off some trees. So a chainsaw is my choice of panic purchase, for today at least. 27 to 12, let us look to the heavens for consolation. And constellations. It's what planetary astronomer and poet Michelle Bannister does. She's just back from Northern Ireland and Canada to take back a lectureship at the School of Physical and Chemical Sciences at the University of Canterbury. And here she is now. Good morning.
Marina.
How are you?
Ah, doing as well as can be expected.
But you are fit and healthy.
Oh, yes. I got back at the start of February.
Just checking that you're not in isolation.
No.
All right. No. Good. Now, we have spoken of recent times about the interstellar comets, the two first known objects formed outside our solar system. One came in late 2017, and then the comet 21 Borisov. You have been studying that, have you not?
Yes, and it's been wonderfully exciting because these are little pieces of tiny planets that formed at another star. So by studying them in the same way that we can study the little worlds that formed in our own solar system, we can understand how planetary systems form around other stars, and we get pieces of them coming right here to work on. So I've been working with a team spread around the world, many in France, some in the UK, and elsewhere, to use one of the very large telescopes in Chile to be able to look at the composition of 2I Borisov and see what it's made of.
When you say little worlds, what do you mean?
When you make a planetary system around a star, it starts with a disk of gas and dust, very fine dust, and that congeals, that accumulates out into little planetesimals, tiny little worlds, maybe the size of an island, maybe the size of a continent. And the smallest ones of those, if they're a little more rocky, we think of them as asteroids. If they're more icy, we think of them as comets. But it's a continuum between the two states. And these little worlds get left over. Some things end up becoming very large and become planets. But these are incredibly numerous. There are trillions on trillions of these tiny worlds made by every star system as it makes its planets. And the process of making those planetary systems means many of them, maybe most of them, get thrown out of the planetary system and go off to wander the stars.
So they're seeds, and some of them fall on fertile ground and some of them don't.
Exactly. Sometimes we get a planet.
And do you know when a planet has formed or is being formed?
We can use telescopes like the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, which is a telescope that looks in longer wavelengths of light in the submillimeter, to be able to see the dust around young stars, to see these forming stellar systems. And so we can see traces of forming planets now in much higher detail than we could before.
It does seem extraordinary that we only know these two objects formed outside our solar system. The first one we became aware of was a really strange one, wasn't it?
Oumuamua was a wonderful surprise, and also in many ways we only got a glimpse of it. We had maybe 2 weeks of where we could use the largest telescopes in the world to study it in detail. And we could see it had some characteristics that were a little like an asteroid, but more characteristics that I would say, it was kind of like the husk of a comet, like a dried out comet.
Just remind me of the difference between an asteroid and a comet, and a meteor and a meteorite. I get confused.
A comet is more where you start seeing this lovely fluffy tail of material coming off the surface as it gets heated by a star and the material starts to sublime It goes straight from being an ice into being this huge cloud of particles. The dust is reflecting the sunlight, and the gas is going out around it, and so you end up with this very fuzzy appearance to it. And an asteroid, you can see the bare surface. So for Oumuamua, we could see the surface directly.
And so it was
a meteor on. A meteor on meteoroid is when it comes into the atmosphere.
Right. So what are you saying? That the first one was an asteroid?
It was more like a dried out comet, I think is what I would now describe it as. Mm-hmm. It had a very weak amount of material coming off it. All we could do to tell it was there was to see how the orbit of the, as it went past the sun, was nudged very slightly by this small amount of material coming off. It was maybe a suitcase worth of ice subliming.
Does that mean that it had been travelling around for a while and had burnt a lot of stuff off?
We're still not sure. This is one of the most exciting things, I think, about studying interstellar objects, is figuring out, of the two that we do have, how they fit into the story of how planetary systems form and evolve. And it's not yet clear how long Oumuamua, or indeed Borisov, has been travelling. So they could be from, you know, they've been travelling at least tens of millions of years, because that's the time it would take to get to even a star that was anywhere near their backwards trajectory in space. But they could have been travelling a lot longer, hundreds of millions of years, maybe even billions. We don't know yet.
How is it that it was such a weird shape?
Well, turns out we do have worlds in our own solar system that are more unusual shapes than even we realised when Oumuamua came by. So not long after that, the New Horizons spacecraft flew by a little world in our solar system, which has now got the beautiful name of Arrokoth. And that has a very unusual shape. It's on an orbit far out in the solar system where it hasn't probably moved very far from where it formed. And so it's effectively primordial. It hasn't changed. It hasn't been heated by the sun. And it looks like two flat pancakes that have gently docked together. So while Oumuamua had a relatively either flattened or elongated shape, that like the way I think of it these days is a bit probably like an overstuffed pita bread, I would say that maybe Oumuamua wasn't as unusual as we really had thought.
It's just, I'm trying to put two things together here in my mind, and one of them must be wrong. One of the reasons why it had lost its tail, had very, very little tail, was rocky, was that it would be travelling for a long time. But if it's been travelling for a long time, wouldn't it have been rounded up? Doesn't that follow?
No, not necessarily. I mean, there's not much in the way. There's not many particles between stars, right? You could say there's one molecule in the entire room is about the level of density of material there is between stars quite often. But I think it's more likely tied to its formation. So how much material it had in it when it formed, perhaps, rather than its past history.
No.
I think this is one of these open questions we have. And having more interstellar objects, more little samples of other planetary systems that come right to our doorstep, that will help to put these kinds of pictures together much more coherently.
But what you're saying is travelling through space does not necessarily make things round.
Not necessarily.
Well, that's a complete misunderstanding on my part. What about the most recent one, the Borisov? We're still looking at that one, are we? I use the word we loosely. You're still looking at that one.
Yeah, the community of astronomers around the world have been studying this. So this one was discovered much less fleetingly. So it was found well before it went past the sun. So we were able to, as a community, to point all the telescopes at it and be able to see how it changed as it came in toward the sun, as it was heated by the sun for possibly the first time since it was formed, or since it you know, at least in very many millions of years. And it seems to be acting like a primordial comet, like something that you might find in our own Oort cloud. It's got a composition. What it's made of is a little different to some of the things in our own solar system, but in many ways it's very similar to the comets we find in our own solar system.
How long is it going to be visible for?
So it's already getting faint enough. We can only see it with the largest telescopes. We could see it with amateur telescopes for a couple of months through early December. But now it's getting fainter for sure. And at the moment, it's sitting right on top of the Milky Way. So if you go out and look, you know, up past the Southern Cross at the middle of the Milky Way, you know, which we can see very nicely in our skies, you can look at the dark places there and go, yeah, that's where the interstellar comet's currently travelling out away from the solar system.
Could one see it with the naked eye at the moment?
It's too faint to see at the moment.
Yeah. Well, at all?
At all, yeah. And so, at the moment, you need a telescope that can get to about 17th magnitude.
All right. And is it going to come closer, or is it going off and off will eventually disappear?
It's gone. It basically did a gentle curve past the sun. It never came closer to the sun than about the orbit of Mars. And so it stayed a very long way out from the sun for this time. And it's gone. It's heading on out. It'll get to the orbit of Jupiter in a couple of years.
And will it eventually disappear, or could it possibly gather more material and become a planet?
It's a lonely wanderer. Unless the only way a small planetesimal can grow into a planet is when it's
what's that word? Planetesimal.
Yeah, a planetesimal, a tiny little protoplanet.
Is that a real word, or did you make that up?
It's what astronomers like using.
Planetesimal. I like it. Sorry, you were saying the only way a planetesimal could become a planet.
Yeah, is when it's in a disk of material where it can be richly fed. So it needs to have a feeding zone, a whole lot of gas and dust around it. And in the very sparse spaces out between stars, there's simply not enough material.
So there is no food for it, and it will slowly decline and eventually disappear. I wonder how long that would take. Do you know?
We're not sure if they would actually erode away. They might end up, it depends on the conditions they travel through, but it might very well be that it would effectively be very little changed for millions on millions of years.
Mega constellations are an increasing concern for the astronomical fraternity and sorority, as well as the people who value just standing around looking at the stars. Can you tell me what they are, the mega constellations?
So this is a thing that are currently being launched by at least two companies around the world, and more are planned for this year. In fact, one of them launched 2 days ago, so they're visible in New Zealand skies. Is a set of satellites that are meant to go into low Earth orbits, so only a few hundred kilometres above the surface of the Earth, and they're meant to orbit there and provide ways of communicating. So the idea is you have, in contrast to the other communication satellites that we have, which are much further out in general, that you have this dense, low network of satellites. And it's called a mega constellation because they're meant to be incredibly numerous. So, for instance, the company SpaceX has approval from the American regulatory body for communications to launch 12,000 of these into low Earth orbit.
Why do they need so many?
They want to be able to hand off between the different satellites as they travel over. And because they're in a low Earth orbit, they travel over you quite fast.
It just seems a ridiculous number. And also, why are they called constellations, which implies some kind of natural configuration, but these are all entirely artificial?
These are entirely artificial. It's a term that started being used in the space technology sector.
But essentially they're used for telecommunication or internet, to make the internet available to more people more affordably.
To enable currency trading, to things of that sort.
Ah, okay. That was a bit judgy. Are you a bit judgy?
There are many purposes you can use this constellation for. At the moment, none of them have provided, that I'm aware of, have provided plans.
None of them have benefited humankind.
Well, these things are done in ways that people are going to pay for it, and they haven't made these funding plans available.
You're being very cryptic. Why don't you just say you think that they should be reduced or stopped?
I mean, the question is, you're saying it's a benefit in that sense, and I'm saying, well, what are they going to charge for this? They're doing this as a, you know, commercial enterprise. That's how they work.
That doesn't mean that they're not going to benefit anybody.
They may be of benefit, but if people can't afford it, then it's not very much benefit.
Ah, well, we don't know. Do you think people won't be able to afford it?
Well, put it this way. The companies that are doing these at the moment, I am trying to pay attention to their actions as much as to what they're saying. And their actions have been that when people, the astronomical community, for instance, say, hey, the brightness of these satellites is something people can see with their eyes, and it is going to be providing a substantial adverse effect on the surveys that we're putting in place to be able to look at the sky. These are going to be things that affect the way people view the sky. There's going to be, you know, I can show you the calculations of how many are going to be visible in New Zealand skies. It's hundreds. When you know that this is going to be the case, and then they continue launching satellites at the rate of 60 every couple of weeks, to the point that there's going to be, you know, several thousand of these up in the next year or several years, their actions are not really matching their what they're saying in terms of that this is going to be a greater good.
This is SpaceX, Elon Musk's SpaceX, that's putting up 60 every fortnight. I'll be Elon Musk for a moment. I say that they'll have zero impact. This is what Elon Musk does say. They will have zero impact once they're in place on astronomical discoveries. I'd like to ask Elon Musk, and indeed you, how one would know whether they had any impact on astronomical discoveries, because you won't know what you don't see if you don't see it.
Well, we know they're having impact at the moment because the wide field astronomical surveys of the sort of things that I myself work on are reporting images being affected by the bright streaks that we see of these satellites going across them. So, you know, you mentioned the observations we were making of the interstellar comet. I had to go and double check to make sure that we weren't going to lose telescope observations of that comet to a Starlink, because one of the things that these satellites do is that they affect the times of the night, in particular dawn and dusk, the hours near that, where you can observe interstellar comets, and where you can detect these things, and particularly where you can see asteroids near the Earth, which is the ones that we try and track to see if there's any potential risk to Earth. There isn't, but we keep tracking to make sure that there isn't.
Is Elon Musk right, though, that once they're in place, they'll have zero effect? It's just that so many keep on going up en route to being in place.
So they're bright when they're going up into place. And at the moment, the brightness that is modelled for where they're going to be when they're fully up, when they're in their final orbits, is very much there that it's going to affect the big sky surveys. So the Vera Rubin Observatory, which is a project that I'm involved in working with, the surveys that will make of the solar system, we're anticipating on the order of 40% of the observations of these will be affected by Starlink satellites.
Wow. Is anybody listening to the astronomical community about these issues?
I know they're trying to talk to some of the satellite companies involved, but talking to the satellite companies and the satellite companies continuing to launch gives me a degree of worry that this that what we're trying to say isn't being responded to very fast.
No. Elon Musk again says, or we'll be able to coach them with something to reduce the glare. But as I understand it, a large part of the glare is the solar panel on these things, and obviously you can't put a coating on that, otherwise it wouldn't be a solar panel anymore.
It's, I mean, this is a technological challenge, and these people are, you know, this is what engineers are very good at, is going, here's a technological challenge, how do you go and solve it? And I understand this one that they have tried modifying, so they've put one up with a modified surface to it, and that one I think was changed by about 0.8 of a magnitude, so it was enough to shift its brightness a little, but not nearly enough that, say, we wouldn't be able to see it with the Vera Rubin Observatory and still be very visible.
Will they be visible to the eye also? I mean, if I look at the night sky in a dark place, every so often I can see a satellite skidding over. Will I be able to see, you know, loads of them all over the show soon?
Yes. So the ones that are currently being launched are visible as a very bright trail of lights while they're going up into orbit. And when they reach their final orbit, what you would see is a point of light going across on a path, and then behind that another point of light going across. And Jonathan McDull, an American astronomer, has done a study which suggests what we'd see in the New Zealand skies is about 25 of these that are bright high in the sky, and then about another 75 or so lower on the horizon that would be very visible to the naked eye. And then there'd be several hundred that are visible, say, if you like doing astrophotography and wanted to make it like a picture of the sky where you see the star trails going across.
Right. And if I were to say to you that technology cannot be stopped, what would you say to me?
I'd say we create technology in a way that we think about what pollution it creates and how we want it to affect our environment. I think we're at a point in history where we're very aware that our technology affects our environment in ways that are both positive and negative. And there, at the moment, is no regulation on the optical brightness of satellites. And these will affect other parts of the wavelength too, the radio, of course, as well. So I think this is a point at which we go, what do we want in our sky? How do we want our skies to look? How does this affect our natural environment?
What's the lifespan of these things? Do you know?
They're quite short. So they're meant to be only up for 5 years or less and then be replaced with more. So part of the thing is with a constellation like this is you have to be continuously relaunching, continuously replenishing it. So you see those streaks, the bright trails of many satellites as they're being launched up on a very regular basis.
So then they're just left to roam around up there as space junk when they're replaced?
They're intended to be deorbited. However, there isn't regulation on how one deorbits in a coherent manner across the world. It's governed by different jurisdictions at the moment. And so how that is going to take place when you have tens of thousands of these satellites in low Earth orbit is something that is a very evolving field in things like space law.
Gosh, it's all interesting and slightly depressing, really. You kind of think the heavens, we haven't messed them up too much now, but we have.
We're at a point of opportunity. We can decide how we want to conserve, how we want to look after the near Earth environment.
You are also a poet, as I said, and I would like you to read one of your poems for us, if you wouldn't mind.
Oh, thank you. So this was a poem that... So I work with colleagues who study the surface of Mars, who explore Mars with Mars rovers. And one of the things about Mars rovers is that you're controlling them remotely. So the way in which you think about a spacecraft that a team of people create and get very emotionally attached to, and then it goes to another planet. And so this poem was about that, about the Mars rovers. Speak data to me. Speak the long, sparse song of descent, dusty discourse poised on sudden flame. Sing of hope, the cooling click of arrival, how cocooned eyes unfurl to pick paths in rough terrain. Speak of your woes, patient, eking out meter on meter, scuffing skeined tangles of tracks, I ask you in return. Gift me the scrape of fingers in coarse soil. My body is always the rover. I am trained into your reach, feeling out the rock, gazing colourless, my eyes set apart as yours, tilt, twist. You are different to your sister. Soul by soul, I shrug each of you onto me. My frame flexed to your posture. Today, I can only move as she does. We are fragile. We take care not to fracture. It would be so easy for this to be the last time we could talk. Tomorrow, my shoulder will also hurt. My far-flung colleagues and I care for you both. We cannot speak eye to eye or touch you as once, years ago, we did. You have moved entirely into our minds. Our arms stretch only as far as yours, yet we hold hands. We talk for hours each day. We all are behind our eyes, turn around, image, go forward. All of us in this body together. My neighbour asks, when will we go to walk on Mars? She puzzles me. We wander there on six wheels every day.
Oh, thanks, Michelle. Michelle Bannister reading her poem, The Ensouling of Spacecraft. She is a lecturer at the School of Physical and Chemical Sciences at the University of Canterbury. It's coming up to midday, and at midday, I believe, there is a Checkpoint Special hosted by Lisa Owen, who's with me now. Hi, Lisa.